arms around me. "Sarah, it's all we could have hoped and more." I could only stand there immobile while she clasped me. Sarah Mapp scooped a handful of flour from the bowl and tossed it over us like petals at a wedding, and their laughter rose into the steamy air. "Think of it! We're to be trained by Theodore Weld," Nina said. He was the man who'd abolitionized Ohio. He was said to be demanding, fiercely principled, and uncompromising. I muddled through the meal and the reading, and when we slipped into bed, I was glad for the dark. I lay still and hoped Nina would think me asleep, but her voice came from her bed, 2 arm lengths away. "I won't go to New York without you." I didn't say I wouldn't go. "Of course I'll go. You've been so quiet. I don't know what to think." I'm overjoyed. I am, Nina. It's just, I'll have to speak. To speak in the most public way. Among strangers. I'll have to use the voice in my throat, not the one on the page. All evening I'd pictured how it would be, the moment when the words clotted on my tongue and the women in New York shifted in their chairs and stared at their laps. "You stood in meetings and spoke," Nina said. "You didn't let your stutter stop you from trying to become a minister." I stared at the black plank of rafter over my head and felt the truth and logic of that. And it came to me that what I feared most was not speaking. That fear was old and tired. What I feared was the immensity of it all. A female abolition agent traveling the country with a national mandate. I wanted to say, "Who am I to do this? A woman?" But that voice was not mine. It was Father's voice. It was Thomas's. It belonged to Israel, to Catherine, and to Mother. It belonged to the church in Charleston and the Quakers in Philadelphia. It would not, if I could help it, belong to me.
Handful. I was down near Adge's Wharf on an errand when the steamboat left the harbor, and it was something in this world. The paddle thundering, the smokestack blowing, and people lined up on the top deck waving handkerchiefs. I watched it till the spume settled on the water and the boat dropped over the last blue edge. Little Missus had sent me to get 2 bottles of import scotch, and I hurried now not to be late. I was the one who did most of her bidding these days. When she sent her plantation slaves to fetch something, they'd come back with the basket empty or still holding the note they were supposed to deliver. They didn't know the battery from Rag Square, and she'd make them go without supper if they were lucky. And if they weren't, it was 5 lashes from Hector. Last week, Sky made up a rhyme and sang it in the garden. "Little Mrs. Mary, mean as a snake, little Mrs. Mary, hit her with the rake." I told her, "Don't sing that, 'cause Hector has ears to hear," but Skye couldn't get the song off her tongue. She'd ended up with the iron muzzle latched on her mouth. It was used for when a slave stole food, but it worked just as good for a slave mouthing off. It took 4 men to hold Skye down, work the prongs inside her mouth, and clamp the contraption at the back of her head. She screamed so loud I bit the side of my cheek till blood seeped and the copper taste filled my mouth. Sky couldn't eat or talk for 2 days. She slept sitting up so the iron wouldn't cut her face. And when she woke groaning, I worked a wet rag under the edge of the gag so she could suck the water. Coming out from the scotch store, I was thinking about the torn places on the sides of her mouth. How she hadn't sung a tune since all that happened. Then I heard shouts and smelled the smoke. A black billow was rising over the old exchange. The first thing that sprang in my head was Denmark, how the city was finally on fire like he wanted. I hitched up my skirt and jabbed the rabbit cane into the cobblestone, trying to make my leg go faster. The scotch bottles clanked in the basket, pain jarred to my hip. On the corner of Broad Street, I stopped in my tracks. What I thought was the city burning was a bonfire in front of the exchange. A mob circled around it, and the man from the post office was up on the steps throwing bundles of papers on the flames. Every time a packet landed, the cinders flew and the crowd roared. I didn't know what they were so stirred up about, and the last thing you want is to wade out in the middle of somebody else's trouble, but I knew little Mrs. doled out whippings for being late, the same as she did for getting lost. I was weaving my way, keeping my head down, when I saw one of the papers they were trying to burn laying on the street, trampled underfoot, and I went over and picked it up. It was singed along the bottom. An epistle to the clergy of the Southern States by Sarah M. Grimke. I stood stock still. Sarah M. Grimke. "Give that to me, nigga," the man said. He was old and bald and smelled sour in the summer heat. "Hand it over." I looked at his red, watering eyes and poked the booklet inside my pocket. This was Sarah's name, and these were her words inside. They could burn the rest of the papers, but they weren't burning this one. Come later this night, Sky and Goodis would come to my bed and say, "Handful, what was you thinking? You should have given that to him." But I did what I did. I didn't pay any heed to what he said. I turned my back and started walking off, getting away from his stink and his grabbing hand. He caught hold of the handle of my basket and gave it a jerk. I yanked back and he held on, swaying on his feet, saying, "What do you think? I'm gonna let you walk off with that." Then he looked down, that half-drunk fool, and saw the bottles of scotch in the basket. The best scotch in Charleston. And his gray tongue came out and wiped his lips. I said, "Here, you take the liquor and I'll take the booklet." And I slid the basket off my arm and left him holding it. I limped off, me and that sly rabbit on the cane, disappearing in the crowd. I kept going past Market Street. The sun was dripping orange on the harbor, the green shadows falling off the garden walls. Up and down the street, the horses were hightailing home. I didn't hurry. I knew what was waiting on me. Near the Grimke house, I saw the steamboat landing and the whitewashed building with a sign over the door, Charleston Steamship Company. A man holding a pocket watch was locking the front door. When he left, I wandered down to the landing and sat behind the wood crates, watching the pelicans dive straight as blades. When I took the booklet from my pocket, little charred flakes came off in my hand. I had to work hard at some of the words. If one tripped me up, I stared at the letters, waiting for the meaning to show itself. And it would come, too, like pictures taking shape in the clouds. Respected friends, I address you as a repentant slaveholder of the South, one secure in the knowledge that the Negro is not chattel to be owned, but a person under God. Little Missus had me whipped by the light of the moon. When I showed up late at the gate without her import scotch or the money she gave me to buy it, she told Hector to take care of me. It was dark out. The black sky full of sharp edge, tin-cut stars, and the moon so full Hector's shadow lay perfect on the ground. He had the bullwhip roundup hanging off his belt. I'd always taken my hope from Mama, and she was gone. He lashed my hands to a post on the kitchen house. The last time I was whipped was for learning to read. One lash, a taste of sugar, they said, and Tomfrey had tied me to this same post. This time, 10 lashes. The price to read Sarah's words. I waited with my back to Hector. I could see Goodis crouched in the shadows by the herb garden, and Skye hidden up next to the woman kitchen, the flash of her eyes like a small night animal. I let my eyelids fall shut on the world. What was it for, anyway? What was any of this for? The first strike came straight from the fire, a burning poker under my skin. I heard the cotton of my dress rip and felt the skin split. It knocked the legs from me. I cried out because I couldn't help it. Because my body was small without padding, I cried out to wake God from his slumber. The words in Sarah's book came fresh to me, a person under God. In my head, I saw the steamboat. I saw the paddle turning. Next day, I was measuring Little Missus for a dress, a walking costume made of silk taffeta, just what everybody needs, and her pretending nothing happened, being obliging. Handful, what do you think about this gold color? Is it too pale? Nobody sews like you do, Handful. When I stretched the measure tape from her waist to her ankle, the tore-up skin on my back pinched and pulled, and a trickle ran between my shoulders. Phoebe and Skye had laid brown paper soaked in molasses on my back to keep the raw places clean, but it didn't turn the pain sweet. Every step I took hurt. I slid my feet on the floor without picking them up. Little Missus stood on the fitting box and turned a circle. It made me think of the old globe in Master Grimke's study, the way it turned. The clapper went off on the front door, and we heard Hector's shoes slap down the hallway to the drawing room where Missus was taking tea. He called out, "Missus, the mayor's here. He's safe for you to come to the door." Mary stepped off the fitting box and stuck her head out to see what she could see. Missus was old now. Her hair paper white, but she got round. I heard her cane fast tapping, and then her toady voice drifted into the room. "Mr. Hayne, this is an honor. Please come join me for tea." Like she caught the big fly. Little Missus started scrambling to get her shoes on. She and Missus were always bragging on the mayor. Mr. Robert Hayne walked on Charleston water. He was what they called a nullifier. "I'm afraid this isn't a social call, Mrs. Grimke. I'm here on official business regarding your daughters, Sarah and Angelina." Little Missus went still. She edged back to the doorway, one shoe on, one shoe off, and I eased over there too. "I regret to inform you that Sarah and Angelina are no longer welcome in the city. You should inform them if they return for a visit, they'll be arrested and imprisoned until another steamer can return them to the north. It's for their own welfare as much as the city's. Charleston is so enraged against them now, they would undoubtedly meet with violence if they showed their faces." It fell silent. The old bones of the house creaked round us. "Do you understand, madam?" the mayor said. "I understand perfectly. Now you should understand me. My daughters may hold unholy opinions, but they will not be treated with this sort of insult and indignity." The front door banged, the cane tapped, then Missus was standing in the doorway with her lip trembling. The measure tape slipped from my fingers. It curled on the floor by my foot. I wasn't likely to see Sarah ever again.
Sarah. Seated on the platform, I watched the faces in the audience grow more rapt as Nina spoke, the air crackling about their heads as if something was effervescing in it. It was our inaugural lecture, and we weren't tucked away in a parlor somewhere before 20 ladies with embroidery hoops on their laps, like the Anti-Slavery Society had first envisioned. We were here in a majestic hall in New York, with carved balconies and red velvet chairs filled to overflowing. All week the newspapers had railed against the unwholesome novelty of two sisters holding forth like Fanny Wrights. The streets had been papered with handbills admonishing women to stay home, and even the Anti-Slavery Society had grown nervous about moving the lecture to a public hall. They'd come close to canceling the whole thing and sending us back to the parlor. It was Theodore Weld who'd stood and castigated the society for their cowardice. They called him the Lion of the Tribe of Abolition, and for good reason. He could be quite forceful when he needed to. "I defend these ladies' right to speak against slavery, anywhere and everywhere. It's supremely ridiculous for you to bully them from this great moment." He had saved us. Nina swept back and forth across the stage, lifting her hands and sending her voice soaring into the balconies. "We stand before you as Southern women, here to speak the terrible truth about slavery." She'd splurged on a stylish, deep blue dress that set off her hair, and I couldn't help wondering what Mr. Weld would think if he could see her. Even though he'd led the training sessions for Nina and me and the 38 other agents, schooling us in the skills of oration, he'd never seemed sure how to advise the two of us. Should we stand motionless and speak softly as people expected of a woman, or gesture and project like a man? "I leave it to you," he had told us. He had taken what he called a brotherly interest in us, visiting us often at our lodgings. It was really Nina he'd taken an interest in, of course, and I doubted it was brotherly. She wouldn't admit it, but she was drawn to him, too. Before arriving in New York, I'd pictured Mr. Weld as a stern old man, but as it turned out, he was a young man, and as kindly as he was stern. 33 and unmarried, he was strikingly handsome, with thick brown, curling hair and biting blue eyes, and he was colorblind to the point he wore all sorts of funny, mismatched shades. We thought it endearing. I was fairly sure, however, it wasn't any of these qualities that attracted Nina. I suspected it was that saving speech of his. It was those five words. "I leave it to you." "The female slaves are our sisters," Nina exclaimed and stretched her arms from her sides as if we were encompassed by a great host of them. "We must not abandon them." It was the final line of her speech, and it was followed by a thunderclap in the hall, the women coming to their feet. As the hand clapping went on, heat washed up the sides of my neck. Now it was my turn. Having listened to me practice my speech, the society men had decided Nina would go first and I would follow, fearing if the order was reversed, few would persevere through my talk to hear her. Getting to my feet, I wondered if the words I planned to say were already retreating. When I stepped to the lectern, my legs felt squishy as a sponge. For a moment, I held on to the sides of the podium, overwhelmed by the realization that I, of all people, was standing here. I was gazing at a sea of waiting faces, and it occurred to me that after my tall, dazzling sister, I must have been a sight. Perhaps I was even a shock. I was short, middle-aged, and plain, with a tiny pair of spectacles on the end of my nose, and I still wore my old Quaker clothes. I was comfortable in them now. "I'm who I am," the thought made me smile, and everywhere I looked, the women smiled back, and I imagined they understood what I was thinking. I opened my mouth and the words fell out. I spoke for several minutes before I looked at Nina as if to say, "I'm not stammering." She nodded, her eyes wide and brimming. As a child, my stutter had come and gone mysteriously just like this, but it had been with me for so long now, I'd thought it permanent. I talked on and on. I spoke quietly about the evils of slavery that I'd seen with my own eyes. I told them about Handful and her mother and her sister. I spared them nothing. Finally, I peered over my glasses and took them in for a moment. "We won't be silent any more. we women will declare ourselves for the slave, and we won't be silent until they're free." I turned then and walked back to my chair while the women rose and filled the hall with their applause. We spoke before large gatherings in New York City for weeks before holding a campaign in New Jersey, and then traveling on to towns along the Hudson. The women